Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Washington is marshaling its resources to combat the coronavirus and its economic fallout. But as time passes, the public's confidence in the federal government to handle this crisis is slipping. In reality, trust in government has been on the decline for decades. Ronald Reagan gave voice to that sentiment in the mid-1980s.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
He may not have been the first person to say that, but the philosophy behind his saying it wasn't just a criticism. It was a call to push government out of the way because the private sector can always do things better. That sentiment has grown like a snowball rolling downhill, especially among Republicans. FEMA's response to Hurricane Katrina became a poster child for the sentiment until now. As Washington struggles to bring needed equipment to hospitals, doctors and nurses, and money into the pockets of citizens and businesses struggling to deal with the complete shutdown of commerce, how can the nation, whose government shepherded people through the Great Depression, helped win World War II and rebuild Europe following the war, conquered polio, built the interstate highway system, sent men to the moon, and created the internet, be capable, or incapable rather, of rising to a crisis? Is it really because government can't solve problems because it is the problem? Or is it because of factions within that government who disdain it and don't want it to work? Either way, diminishing trust in government isn't healthy for our democracy, and as our guest today says, if people think that government isn't competent to keep us safe, it will be even worse, much worse. That is the opinion of Mark Hetherington, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, and the co-author of Why Washington Won't Work, Polarization, Political Trust, and the Governing Crisis. And he joins us for the hour from his home in Chapel Hill. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why Washington Won't Work isn't the only book you've written on the topic of trust in government. In 2007, you wrote Why Trust Matters, Declining Political Trust and the Demise of American Liberalism. And you've also written more than a few articles on this same topic. Americans have always been suspicious of government. I think it's in our genes. It started with the Revolution. But when did we really begin to lose trust in the modern government? Because I remember, when I was a kid, we trusted it.
Absolutely. I would say that the decline in trust in government may be the most important trend that we've seen in American politics in the last 60 or 70 years. And again, just to put it into some perspective, you know, back when, you know, you and I were kids, upwards of 60, 70% of Americans, when asked the following survey question, how much of the time do you think you can trust the government to do what's right? 60 or 70% of us would ordinarily say either just about always, or at least most of the time. Just to put it into some perspective, the last time the Pew Foundation carried out a similar study, less than 20% said either just about always or most of the time. So this is the most fundamental change that we've seen in outlook as it relates to anything involved with politics. And where we see it start is the early, late 1960s and early 1970s. That's the turning point. And we have a couple of upturns in there when the economy got better in the 1980s. And we also got a spike in trust in the early 2000s, right after 9/11. But for the most part, it's been a story of decline since then.
You mentioned the Pew Research Center, and they showed that trust in government reached its peak in 1964, when 77% of Americans viewed government favorably. And today, we're at around 17%. I've forgotten the figure that you threw out, but that's the number that I have. At the same time, we're witnessing this low ebb in trust in government. We're also living through a time when people don't trust the public schools. They don't trust churches and other formerly unassailable institutions. And of course, they don't trust the media. Is all this connected in some way?
You know, I think in some ways it is. I think, you know, you bring up a really important point. Trust in government specifically has taken an extraordinary hit. Probably the only institution that's taken it worse is the media, as you point out. But whether it's scientific organizations or whether it is medicine or whether it's religion or pretty much anything that you could imagine, we've seen a decline in trust, not just in the United States, but in a lot of different places over time. There seems to be just a more critical eye that people focus on things as it relates to our organized institutions. I will say the only exception to that rule is the U.S. military. The U.S. military is the one institution that seems to have maintained an extraordinarily high level of and positive feelings toward. But when it comes to government, and you touched on an important reason for that at the beginning, and that is what Ronald Reagan and really generations of politicians have done, and that is criticize it. These types of institutions that used to be so venerable, so important to us, you know, everybody used to believe in, have been the object of criticism from a whole wide range of actors in life, whether, again, it's scientists or medical personnel or religion. All of these things are getting lots and lots of criticism, whereas they didn't. And so we end up with a big drop off in levels of.
Well, I was going to ask. I was going to ask you if today's lack of trust is based on failures, government failures. Is it because the government actually can't be trusted to do things well or do things right or to do the right thing, or is it because of politicians, people running for office who are saying government bad, I'll fix it for you, or I'll make it tinier for you.
Yeah. Drowned in the bathtub, as the conservative politicians say these days. It's a great question, and it's a combination of factors. Certainly, when, you know, again, you and I were young, 70%+ trust in government, that started to drop off, and a big part of that was performance. You know, we had the Vietnam War, we had Watergate, we had the Carter malaise, you know, the stagflation that happened in the 1970s. There was good reason for trust in government to drop off during those periods. So performance was part of it. But one of the things that changed, and I think this was an especially important change that took place in the 1980s. You know, you remember when Barry Goldwater ran for president in 1964, he criticized government as not being a place or an institution that ought to be involved in certain, you know, the idea was, well, you know, the government, the federal be involved in state matters. It was a philosophical argument. What Reagan and the people who came after him started to argue was it wasn't so much philosophical. It was that the government was incompetent to do these various different things. And, you know, as time went by, nobody took up the government side of that argument anymore and said, look, you know, government actually is capable and has a lot of capacity to do a lot of good in society. So we ended up with this sort of like one-sided argument that government is bad among politicians. And nobody was out there saying, hey, you know, government accomplishes all of these things that you just don't think about.
And Democrats are generally thought of as being people who like government, who think government can do and should do things for the citizens. And Republicans have been thought of as people who are business oriented and who think the private sector can do it better. And what the government can do best is just get the hell out of the way. Who's right?
Well, it's a great question. And I think the bottom line is both sides are right, depending upon the areas. And I think most people would suggest that when government and business work in partnership about different things, that a lot of good things happen. So it's not necessarily a question of, you know, is government competent or not. It's in what areas do we need government to be able to do a job? And right now, of course, in dealing with coronavirus and COVID-19. What other set of institutions have the capacity to deal with the crisis? And the answer to that is no other institutions do. You know, we need people to believe in the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration and the various health and human services departments and FEMA, because those are the institutions that are going to be able to deliver the types of things that the public needs at this particular moment in time.
You've also written a lot about the polarization that we have been experiencing for a very long time now in this country. That division includes diametrically opposed visions of what government can and should do. How much of the diminishing trust that we're experiencing is coming from one side as opposed to the other, and the side that believes that the government shouldn't do anything?
Yeah, well, it's gotten to be, you know, it's pretty complicated lately. But, you know, if we're looking for, you know, a political party or a political side, you know, and you've made this point, I think, very well, you know, it's really been part of the conservative playbook for the last 40 years that government is incapable of doing X, Y, and Z. And, you know, it's a strategy that wins votes. You know, certainly Ronald Reagan, who's the patriarch of modern conservatism, you know, he made it clear. He won, you know, 49 out of 50 states with that, you know, sort of mantra. And Republican politicians ever since then have learned from Reagan's approach to campaigning. Government's the problem. It's not the solution to our problems. So, you know, with that as a philosophy of governing, it kind of makes sense that Republicans right now are having a pretty hard time with a crisis that requires the government to be able to do things. And, you know, this sort of, it's not a benign approach to campaigning any longer. You know, what, you know, this has become, I think, a philosophy within the political right that government really is the issue here. And so you have hundreds of vacancies that the Trump administration has left in the CDC and so forth. There is a lack of expertise because, again, I think there is this philosophy that government's a problem.
Did that idea come from the top down? In other words, when Ronald Reagan said government can't solve the problem, it is the problem, I'm paraphrasing, did it come from the top down, or was he responding to something that was gurgling up from the base and he knew that would be something that would resonate with them?
Well, that's a great question. And I think it's always a combination, right? Because if there wasn't something gurgling at the base, you know, among us ordinary people, then that message wouldn't have resonated as powerfully, you know, as it did. So there were a lot of concerns. And remember, you know, the 1970s were not an especially good time, you know, and the late 1960s were, you know, a time of incredible chaos. And America maybe losing its place in the world order. So, you know, Americans were feeling very uneasy about the role that government was playing and so forth. Reagan tapped into it, right? But the interesting thing about Reagan is, you know, he still relied a lot on expertise. You know, he had a killer cabinet, you know, a group of people who were excellent at governing and provided great leadership to the cabinet departments. What's happened since then is, and it's really after George H.W. Bush, because he also had a great cabinet and you know, real professionals in government. It's really been in the last 20 years or so that philosophy that there's something broken about government has become something more than just a rhetorical device.
I want to come back to that because I think as people bought into the idea, maybe they already felt this, but somebody gave they gave life to it by saying government's the problem at the political party level. As that happened, people began to respond to it. They began to elect people to office who believed that. And what was the impact of electing people to office who believe that the government shouldn't do anything? Does it become a self-fulfilling prophecy? We'll get an answer to that and talk about the expertise that were in the cabinets of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush as opposed to today when we come back. Our guest is Mark Hetherington, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina and the co-author of Why Washington Won't Work. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Hetherington is with us, professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill and the co-author of Why Washington Won't Work, Polarization, Political Trust, and the Governing Crisis. One of our emailers has made an interesting point. Democrats have co-opted this message of government's the problem in a way. Bill Clinton, when he was elected, said the era of big government is over. Did he say that because he knew he had to say it when he was up for re-election, because that sentiment was seeping through all sectors of society, or did he really believe it as a Democrat?
Oh, I think that he did it because he needed to get elected. One of the things that's really important, you know, to always keep in mind is candidates say things to win elections. You know, I mean, it's just the way that the system works. And what politicians of both, you know, conservative, well, especially in the conservative camp, realized is, like you were getting at earlier, there is this sort of latent, you know, sort of anti-government sentiment that was left over from the failures of the 60s and the 70s, and they tapped into it. But you remember, think about the beatings that Democrats took. You know, Carter won five states in 1980. Mondale won one state in 1984. Bush won a huge victory over Dukakis in 1988. But Democrats by 1992, and Bill Clinton was better at this than most people, was that we run as a pro-government party anymore. We're going to get killed all the time. So, you know, he started to adopt a good bit of that language as well. Now, that being said, you know, the Democrats remained a much more pro-government party. And, you know, of course, Barack Obama's championing of Obamacare is the best example of that over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. But it gets to your point. Neither side is out there saying government's the solution.
When you have at least one side, this is mostly on the right. I'm sure that there are Democrats who think that government is too big and does it gets involved in too many things and spends too much money. But it generally is Republicans spend all the money when they get into office. At the same time, they're saying government bad. Let's make it smaller. Let's make it so it fits into a teacup like Grover Norquist has advocated. But when Americans buy into that and they elect politicians who espouse that philosophy and they get into office and then they run the government that they don't like in the first place, what's the result of that?
Well, a real lack of attention to the types of nitty-gritty that government does. And I want to take one step back and make a point. You know, government's giant, right? I mean, government has reach of 1,000 hydras. But what does government really do? And what government really does, what it spends most of its money on, is things like Social Security and Medicare and the Defense Department. People actually love those things. And if people thought about government as providing those services, they'd be delighted with government. But what conservative politicians over years have basically been able to do is redefine in the American mind what government mostly does. And what they've suggested is it's mostly welfare and it's mostly foreign aid. Americans wildly overestimate the percentage of dollars that the government spends on things like welfare and foreign aid. The combination of those two is way under 10% of the federal budget.
Right.
And yet Americans tend to think it's about 50% of the federal budget. So, you know, so this is going to create part of the issue.
But you have said that Republicans have internalized what used to be just a political strategy, which increases the chance that the government will fail. Mm-hmm. So if you run on, I'm going to shrink the size of government because government needs to get out of the way, and you succeed at that, what does that do to people's trust in government? Because it seems to me that if you limit what government can do because you've hollowed it out, yep, and then something happens like the coronavirus, you can't respond.
You're 100% right. And, you know, we've seen, you know, the course of the last number of months and weeks, you know, the reporting that's focused on exactly those issues. So, you know, the Center for Disease Control is going to play a central role in any, you know, dealing with the virus. And the Trump administration, of course, has failed to fill hundreds of vacancies in the CDC over time. They just don't think it's important. You know, one of the things that really went wrong during the Bush administration, the first Bush or the George W. Bush administration, was FEMA. You know, during Hurricane Katrina, they didn't have very good and professional people who were running that institution at that point. So they were terrible at dealing with it. You know, you have the pandemic task force in the National Security Council that the previous President Barack Obama had put into place to provide advice and counsel to the president about pandemics. And of course, it was done away with in the with the idea in mind that it was just another level of bureaucracy that needed to be dealt with. So, you know, again, running against government can be benign under most circumstances. I mean, I think it's a cynical strategy to do that. But when we find a moment like right now, we really need it. We need that expertise that government usually supplies, and we don't have it.
But it also seems to me even the most ardent conservative, even the most ardent libertarian person who doesn't, who believes the government should get out of the way, would want the government to do certain things. And one of the things it says in the Constitution is provide for the common defense. That means health and welfare, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it mean that they need to keep us safe, whether it's from a foreign enemy or it's from a virus?
Absolutely. But here's the thing that's interesting. Of course, conservatives have never wanted to cut spending on defense for exactly the reason that you suggest. That is the key role that government plays, right? I mean, it's keeping the country safe. But what, again, we don't think about very much is the threat that we would get from a virus. That doesn't necessarily seem like thing that ought to be on the top of our minds when it comes to maintaining the common defense. And so in a sense, you know, this took, you know, the movement in a lot of ways by surprise. This wasn't the kind of attack that anybody, you know, saw coming.
So getting back to something you talked about in the last segment, where you have Ronald Reagan, who says government's the problem, and the nine most scary words is, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. He still staffed his administration and the departments at the cabinet level with experts in the areas of which they oversaw. Same thing was true with President George H.W. Bush and with, I guess, a succession of Democrats. And right now we have people, it's like the fox guarding the hen house in some people's minds, because a lot of people who have been appointed to these cabinet positions used to be in the industries that they oversee or lobbyists for the industries they oversee. And many of them, now that we're 3 years into it, are acting. They haven't been approved by Congress because the president likes the ability to shuffle the deck. But they're not qualified in many cases. So why did Ronald Reagan think it important, if he didn't like government and he thought it should be smaller, why was it important to him to have qualified people in those positions? And why have we walked away from that idea?
Well, I think the conservative movement back in the 80s were serious about governing. They thought we should keep it smaller and we should be more efficient and we should have government focused on the right things. And on those right things, the government, you know, is going to be capable. And it's amazing, you know, during the Reagan years, trust in government, even though he's campaigning against government in, you know, being involved in too many things, the success of the Reagan administration was such that trust in government goes up actually quite a bit during the Reagan years because it was good, because it was successful, the successful administration. But, you know, sometimes ideas, just general ideas, start to have a corrosive effect. And this idea that Reagan set in motion, I think, started to have a corrosive effect on conservatives' view of what government can do. And, you know, I think Donald Trump is the embodiment of that. You know, he is not government. He's a businessman. He's a reality TV star. He won the nomination of the party because he was from completely out in left field as it relates to the government. He was able to make that case that government was the problem, not the solution, better than anybody else. You know, so, you know, that in a sense, that set of ideas became, again, corrosive to the overall approach to running a government, actually.
Our guest is Mark Hetherington. He's a professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill and the co-author of Why Washington Won't Work, Polarization, Political Trust, and the Governing Crisis. I have an email here, which also goes together with a question from one of our producers, which kind of, they're kind of married here. The email says from Donna, I wonder how much of the distrust in government comes from years of career politicians. And I'm wondering why people who don't like the government fight so hard to get into it and fight so hard to stay in the government. I know the benefits are pretty good, but what's the real reason?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, so I think one of the big things is that, you know, people want to become career politicians in order to affect a certain change in the way government functions. So even if you're a serious anti-government person, you know, you're representing that side of the debate is really important to maybe accomplishing what you think the goals of government ought to be. That being said, I find it to be an incredible irony, you know, that, you know, and we see this all the time, you know, the sort of anti-government, you know, pro-term limits people, once they themselves get into office, they all of a sudden think, oh, wait a minute, I think I'm going to stick around a little bit longer. I know that I said I was only going to stay for three terms and 6 years in the House, but, you know, I'm really good at this. I'm going to stick around and do it. You know, it is an interesting question, though, and I'm going to point it in a slightly different direction. What if we have a situation where being in government is a low status occupation, whether it's holding office or whether it is, you know, being part of the federal bureaucracy? Who's going to do it? Not the best and the brightest. You know, if we've created a situation where, you know, the public at large sees the government as being, you know, dangerous and problematic, who wants to grow up and be part of that system? If we think that office holders are crooked and always looking to line their own pockets, who are going to be the people who step up and do that job? Not the types of people that did it in the 1940s and the 1950s, who did it as service to the country. Instead, we're going to get whatever we get. And it's, you know, it's probably not going to work out as well.
Are you saying then that this philosophy and the acting on this philosophy for years and years and years is actually bankrupting us? It's a bankrupt philosophy. It works against itself. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think that's the perfect way to put it. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, at a certain level. And, it ordinarily doesn't end up being much of a problem, right? Because, most of what government does is, you know, Social Security and Medicare and defense and, you know, so forth. But when something really complicated happens and you have to coordinate the CDC and the FDA and Department of Health and Human Services in order to get tests out into the field, to coronavirus tests, to be able to see who has it, and you don't have the best people running the government to do it, chances are that it's not going to happen as well as if you did have the best people and the best leaders running those types of departments.
I suppose your point of view on what kind of a job the Trump administration is doing to respond to this crisis is highly partisan. I'm sure there are Republicans who think he's doing a great job, and he tells us every day at these press briefings that his administration is doing the best job in the history of the country in handling this. But it seems to some that the Trump administration's response is disorganized. It's certainly out of the norm. He said he is not a store clerk. He's told the governors, you're on your own. You handle the situation, which has put the governors in a position to have to bid against each other and even against the federal government for needed supplies. And at the same time, he's telling everybody we're doing a great job here. As citizens, should our point of view on this effort, on how it's being conducted, depend on our political affiliation? Or is there a gold standard against which this response can be measured?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And it really ties us back into the question about polarization that you mentioned before. You know, as our political parties in Washington have gotten more polarized over the last 15 or 20 years, it's really changed public opinion in a way that you can hardly imagine. And what we do now is simply follow our leaders of our favored party, as opposed to following, you know, reality, you know, in a sense. There's a, you know, an old phrase, you know, we tend to see the world the way we want to see it rather than how it really is. And to a greater and greater extent, that's what partisanship is doing to political reality these days. And, you know, we see this in presidents' approval ratings over the last 20 years or so. You know, almost no Democrats liked George Bush, almost no Republicans liked Barack Obama, almost no Democrats liked Donald Trump. But like, you know, when you and I were growing up, the difference between Republicans and Democrats' views of the president, whether it was Johnson or Nixon or Ford, was only about 30 percentage points. Now it's 70.
And we trusted them to do what was in the best interest of the country, even if we didn't necessarily believe or agree with their political philosophy. We didn't hate the opposite party. We just would prefer that our guy would be there. Now mm-hmm. we hate the opposite party.
And I think this is an extraordinarily important development because, you know, think about this. When you really hate somebody, like in your just regular everyday life, what are you willing to believe about them? Pretty much anything, right?
They're bad.
You'd believe any rumor or bad story about them. Well, you know, the same thing is what's going on in politics. You're willing to believe any bad thing, you know, whether it's true or not, about your political opponents. And, you know, and you're not even rooting for your political opponents to do well, even when they're doing well is important for the country. You know, we should all be rooting for a good response as it relates to the virus right now, because tens of thousands of lives are on the line.
Yes.
But we hate the other side so much that I feel like we're not actually doing that at this point.
You've written a lot about this political divide in articles and books, and it boils down, you say, if I'm going to paraphrase here, not to political ideology necessarily, but to a basic worldview, a philosophy about life. There's this authoritarian streak in our current leadership that a lot of people fear is a response to wanting to make the world neat, mm-hmm. orderly, tidy, safe for us to live in. And if you believe that the world is dangerous, the government's job is to make it safe. Okay, so this virus isn't safe, and yet many who hold on to that philosophy of life don't feel threatened by the virus because they've been told it's going to go away. I want to come back to that. We have to take a break. Rats. We'll come back to that in just a couple of seconds. Our guest is Mark Hetherington, professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. If you're looking for more conversations around local and national politics, then look no further than Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte. WFAE's new podcast covering the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/insidepolitics. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Mark Hetherington. He is the professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, co-author of many books, but the one we're talking mostly about is Why Washington Won't Work, Polarization, Political Trust, and the Governing Crisis. The irony of people who support who have a conservative political philosophy, which they look at the world and they see it as a dangerous place, and they want government to make them safe, which explains Republican support and conservative support for a strong military, for closing borders, etc. For them not to see this virus as something that's dangerous, that the government should be working hard to keep us safe from, seems to be ironic, because right now it is the one thing that can really do you in. They're being told by the president, or they were told for a long time by the president, that this was not to worry about it. We're going to be fine. Fox News repeats that. They believe that.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And I think that this is a really interesting moment because, first of all, imagine what this group of people would be feeling, what the reaction would be if Hillary Clinton had been elected president and we were dealing with this crisis. My sense is that the conservatives would be freaking out about it. And the reason, again, is this polarization. You know, even a virus, even something that's threatening 100,000 to a million lives, is getting tied up in our politics. So I think there are two different levels to this. The first one that you're pointing up is the information that people who are connected to Fox News and Breitbart and so forth, and the president himself, are getting. You know, for months they've been encouraged to minimize, these the virus and the circumstances and so forth, and they want to believe that, right? Because their president is the guy who's in charge, you know, right now. And then the second piece of this is, you know, there's been a lot that has happened over the course of the last 3 years that might cause Trump supporters an awful lot of cognitive dissonance. That is, you know, starting to question, you know, whether supporting him was maybe the best idea. And they've gotten through all of that and continue to support him and so forth. You know, maintaining a good feeling about themselves is a huge part of why conservatives continue to minimize this. They don't want to sort of admit, look, this is not actually going all that well. This causes me a certain amount of psychological pain to suggest that, oh my gosh, you know, this philosophy about governing, you know, maybe government really is important. You know, maybe expertise in these various different things is a good thing. And so they push it away. They continue to argue against this, you know, actually being important. And then finally, the last thing that I would add is this. You know, if you're in, people are experiencing a lot of different realities these days. If you're from a more outlying area where there aren't very many cases, coronavirus probably doesn't seem like that big of a deal relative to if you're in a big city like Charlotte or New York or Atlanta. And, you know, with that in mind, Republicans tend to live disproportionately in outlying areas. So I think all three of these things add up to why we have this sort of partisan split that we have right now in response to the virus.
And I was going to ask you if you thought, depending on how this all turns out, that this would increase either trust in government or that would change the way people view government's function and its role and how involved it should be in our lives. But I read that you said that if the government succeeds in keeping the carnage from this virus to a minimum during this crisis, it is unlikely to change much about what Americans think about government, because Americans already think, you say, that government can do this. If, however, the government doesn't succeed, it has the potential to further undermine trust in government. And you go on to say something that I found really attention-getting. People already don't trust government to redistribute money and provide certain services, which is bad. If they come to think it is not competent to keep us safe, it will be even worse. So this government is trying to do both of these things in this crisis: keep us safe from the virus and distribute money to businesses and individuals. And evidently that part of it is not going well at all, not smoothly at least. What if they fail at one but not the other?
Well, then it probably, so this gets back to your question or your point a little while ago, this notion of providing for the common defense. You know, this is actually weirdly something that people trust the government to do. It doesn't seem like it, because we always tell survey interviewers that we don't trust the government to do what's right. But right after 9/11, when we were thinking about providing for the common defense, trust in government level shot up, because that was the part of government that we were being encouraged to think about at that particular moment, right? So we actually do trust the government to do that stuff. What if we fail? What if the government fails at doing exactly that thing right now? You know, instead of a threat from terrorists, you know, it's a threat from a virus. Those high levels of trust to keep us safe that, you know, Americans actually do have, you know, deteriorates. Now, if they are able to keep us safe, then that meets our expectations, and trust in government won't go up, it won't go down, it'll just stay the same. And then you have the other point: if the government fails at getting the money into this place or that place or the other place, that's just going to reinforce the, you know, stereotype that we have that government can't do anything other than keep us safe and secure. But I'm really quite worried, you know, at this point, because, you know, tens of thousands of lives have been, you know, jeopardized. You know, even Anthony Fauci said yesterday or the day before that a quicker response would have led to saving a lot of lives at this point. And, you know, the reason that we responded so poorly was, again, because of this philosophy about government.
Last night, I believe it was, the president retweeted a tweet. I'm not sure who originated the tweet, but he said, "Fire Fauci." Dr. Fauci is the one person out there on those briefings every night that seems to be walking a tightrope with not wanting to contradict the president, but on the other hand, wanting to give out medically accurate information. A March 10th to 15th NBC News Commonwealth Fund poll asked, how much do you trust President Trump to provide information about the coronavirus epidemic? A majority, 53%, said they either had no trust at all or little trust. 40% said no trust at all. 13% said little trust. 30% said they either completely trust or mostly trust the president. That means that both Republicans and Democrats don't have a lot of faith or trust in the information coming from the mouth of the president of the United States. Is the president synonymous with the government in people's minds?
Well, and this is really a big part of it. Over the years, the president has become the embodiment of what the government is. You know, back when I started to do my research when I was in graduate school, there was very little difference in trusting government levels between Republicans and Democrats, no matter who was in office, whether a Democratic president was in office or a Republican president was in office. But starting at the end of the Bush administration and in Obama, and especially now in the Trump administration, trusting government scores have polarized. Where people who are of the party of the president, they trust it, and the people who are not of the party of the president, none of them trust it.
Right.
So your observation is exactly right. And it's a real concern as it relates to Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx and the other doctors who the public seems to have some faith in. You know, if the president, you know, is not able to cope with their mild criticisms of him and, you know, and sends them packing at some point, that might be the place where he finally starts to pay a political price among Republicans for his approach to this whole crisis.
Go ahead.
Republicans like those doctors.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, they like these doctors, but in the last several years, not just Donald Trump, but particularly Donald Trump, have been criticizing elites, whether they are academic elites or whether they are media elites or whether they are scientists. They don't trust science. They deny science. Climate change comes to mind. These doctors, Birx and Fauci, are trusted by people. Suddenly science has a point of view that people trust.
Yep.
How's that going to change? How will that change this mantra about the elites being part of the problem?
Well, I really hope that that is something that we can actually change. And maybe, you know, if science is the thing that gets us past this situation, you know, this is a real opportunity to, again, you know, maybe things like climate change will get a little bit more attention because, you know, those blanket indictments of what scientists do won't hold the same way that they do in the prior environment before coronavirus. But, you know, science is, and again, you know, the decades-long war against science is another that the GOP has waged is another clear problem right now. Who's going to come up with the vaccines? Who's going to come up with the antivirals? Who's going to come up with the plans about social distancing? Science, you know, is going to do those types of things. And it is interesting, you know, despite all of the concerns that I had about the way the public would respond, they really do seem to be doing those things by and large. Social distancing, you know, and now I'm starting to see a fair number of masks at grocery stores and things like that. This is all to the good. So, you know, in the long run or the medium term, maybe we will see esteem and trust for scientists start to recover back to levels that we saw decades ago.
couple of comments that have come in from listeners while we've been talking. Twitter comment, don't forget the Reagan appointees who were focused on destroying their agencies, like EPA head Ann Gorsuch. She left in disgrace amid scandal and mismanagement. And there was the anti-environmentalist James Watt at the Interior Department. Matt emails, I've worked throughout my entire career with several federal agencies. It's fair to say the dysfunction at the staff level is as broken as it is at the political appointment level that crosses multiple administrations, since they are frequently life employees. And that is a frequent complaint about the government. Most people only interface with the government at the DMV and maybe a place to get your marriage license or something like that. And they look at these people who are slow to respond. They don't pick up the phone. They don't get back to you. And they think that's what government is. They're just incapable. They're just lazy.
Yeah, and you see some of that bureaucratic bloat getting in the way of the response, even about the testing issues. You know, the stories that some of the national papers have done on why the coronavirus testing failed points to a lot of that lack of communication and layers of bureaucracy being a real problem. So I don't mean to suggest government's got all of the solutions at this point, but with good leadership, you know, to get the red tape cut and so forth, it's the only hope we got, at this point. Would it be great if it weren't, quite as bloated as it would be? Sure. But it's the only hope. It's the only set of institutions that we have that are arrayed in a way that allows us to deal with this virus.
During the healthcare debates that took place during the Clinton and again during the Obama administrations, one of the arguments was that people did not want the government to stand in between them and their doctor, and yet people on Medicare, which is a government program, are generally happy with that program. Was this distrust of government and its intersection with healthcare organic, or was it stoked by one faction?
Absolutely. One of the things that we show in research, there was no factor that was more powerful in turning people against any various of the forms of healthcare reform that we've seen on the table since the 90s up through Obamacare than those negative feelings that let the lack of trust that they have in government. And again, it's one of those things we know is out there because of people's experience with the DMV or whatever it might be. We have this sort of negative association with government. And then it can be stoked, by opponents of a given program, whether it's, insurance companies or, whatever it might be, just to cause people some doubt. And when it comes to something like your health insurance, you don't want to have doubts. And so you don't want to change. You don't want government, more involved in those types of things. You don't like your insurance company, but you really don't like the government.
Right. Do you think that this crisis, which is has thrown a lot of people out of work and therefore who will lose their employer-based health care, at least in 6 months after COBRA goes away, that this will change their minds about some sort of universal or government-led health care program, insurance program?
Well, one of the things that, yes, I think it will. But it depends on how long the economic crisis lasts, afterwards. We're going to see double-digit unemployment almost certainly. Right. We may have double-digit unemployment now. If the economy doesn't recover quickly, we're going to have double-digit unemployment well past people losing their COBRA. And at that point, you're going to have to turn to government sources for your coverage.
So I have 90 seconds left, and I have an important two-part question.
All right.
Can you have the kind of society and the kind of government and the kind of organization that we have in America if you don't trust the government? Can you have it? Does it work? And how do you restore trust? How do you get back to where we were, say, when Eisenhower was president?
Yeah. So can we have good governance without trust in government? And the answer to that is it's very, very hard. Because, as we talked about, who are the people who are going to go into government, if it's a low status occupation, who are going to be the people who do those jobs? It makes it much more difficult. As it relates to recovering trust in government, what government has got to do is perform. It's got to do well. And you know, when government performs well, as it did during the Reagan years, as it did in the late Clinton years, as it did later in the Obama years, trust in government goes up. So what right now government is get the job done. And if they get the job done, we'll, you know, we'll respond as a public.
Mark Hetherington is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, the author of many books, the co-author of Why Washington Won't Work, Polarization, Political Trust, and the Governing Crisis. Thank you very much for the hour. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.